You are a problem. Maybe the biggest problem of all. No, the crashing router code is the biggest problem. Or the leaking memory in the switch. Or firewall sandwiches are too hard to administrate. That's the problem. Or the app needs layer 2 stretch between data centers. And what problem could be worse than that? Well, today on the show, we're here to argue that, no, it's you and me and everyone else you work with. And with us today to defend the idea that technology problems are really people problems is Yvonne Sharp, network architect and co-founder of the Network Collective. Yvonne, welcome to Packet Pushers.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here today to talk about everybody.
That's right. It's a creeping gossip session. That's what's going to happen.
That's right.
Because we care about people that we talk about people.
Well, to lead this thing off, I have for years, and especially early in my career, felt like if we could just get the technology understood and ironed out and working well, that would solve so many of our problems. And the thing that I'm beginning to understand is that people actually run the technology and use the technology, and so much of what's wrong in our organizations and with how we do things is not so much the tech. It's there's a deeper problem, and it's the people. And there's a lot to that, not really individuals, but more what happens when you get a bunch of individuals together in a hierarchical structure to try and accomplish a thing. It seems like that's way harder than maybe I used to give it credit for.
It's funny you put it that way. You just brought to mind a very vivid memory I have of one of the several times I've had a run-in either with my manager or human resources. And this was a people problem. I was very frustrated with one of my coworkers. It would have been someone who was, you were talking about a hierarchy and having that hierarchy, Yvonne. And right, hierarchically, this person was not connected to me, but happened to impact my world quite a lot. And we were trying to get a thing done. And the thing that frustrated me was not the technology so much. It was this person I was working with who was just so difficult because they had to be very controlling and make it difficult to implement the technology through their personality and through their desire to be the one with through whom all of the decisions had to go, even though they didn't have a lot to offer in many circumstances. So it wasn't that the project was so hard, although it was kind of. It was more some of the personalities involved that caused me at this particular moment to slam the door and make a certain person in the office feel threatened by my aggression.
I've never thought you to be a violent person, Ethan.
You know, people can get me there. That's for sure. People can get me there.
I've specialized in that over the years.
Violence?
Everybody's got to have a gift.
Getting Ethan stressed and oh, <got it. laughs>
You were not the coworker I was referring to, actually. But.
Well, and a lot of times problems crop up that are ultimately people problems, and then we try to fix them with technology or systems or processes. I'm convinced that that's how we end up, and I've seen it happen in several organizations with these crazy change management processes, right? Somebody made a mistake at one point in time that was really either they failed to communicate something or they failed to check something or they just made an honest mistake or they didn't have all the information. And then instead of just looking at that problem and dealing with that directly, we build this whole big system so that that thing can never happen again, and then subject everyone to that when it doesn't really apply in most circumstances.
I think you just described ITIL. Everything about ITIL is a reaction to idiot employees.
Well, it's also a reaction to complexity and
yeah, to some extent, but
and
also
how we build things. I think it's more a reaction to people than it is to technology.
Yeah. I think there's two parts to ITIL. And ITIL is sort of a broad term for process and procedure and checks and balances and let's have an approval or a sign-off on a review, you know. You've tripped over your shoelaces, we'll take away your shoelaces, we'll make sure that you're only allowed to have shoes with Velcro on them because you're obviously incompetent at doing shoelaces. You know, it can't be an accident and we have to have a process to handle it. That's the sort of thing that happens. And a lot of what ITIL does is, you know, they've employed somebody who's an idiot. They don't want to sack him because that actually is a bit too much like hard work. So they put a change control board in place so idiots can be prevented from being idiots. And really what they should have done is gone, you're an idiot, get out of here.
Well, and the more we rely on these big systems to check things, the less our people want to take personal accountability for them. And so if there's a problem, I have seen circumstances in which the person justifies themselves even for bad code by saying, well, I followed the process. I did steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 that I'm required to do. And it just didn't work, as opposed to saying, okay, what can we do as individuals in the future to keep that from happening? What can we do to enforce that, this big process on the entire organization? Well, I don't want to camp out here too long, because most of us are not in a position to fix these kind of problems in our organization.
But what you are alluding to is the organizations have been identified to fit into different styles and different cultures in which they operate. And this was a blog post that you brought up as we were preparing for the show, the Westrum typology, the three different organizational types that fit in. And you just described one of them that sounded like the bureaucratic organization to me. Why don't you walk us through the three types that were outlined in a blog post on the Westrum typology, measuring culture, by Andy Kelk, who was talking about that in a DevOps context.
Sure. So the study outlines three categories of organizations. The first is my favorite, because it defines them as pathological organizations, where they're power oriented, people don't cooperate with one another, people shirk their responsibilities. If there's a problem, then we find a scapegoat. We don't really allow any novelty. And that is defined as a pathological organization. And I think I like the word pathological, because it really doesn't make any sense. People behave in those ways that really don't help you reach an objective. But once an organization is pathological, they don't really care about the objective anymore. They care about either their turf, or they care about this power struggle to gain authority, or they care about something other than the mission of the organization, which is frankly sad.
It's not getting the network deployed or getting the system working. It's the process. As long as you followed the process, you say it wasn't supposed to work. It's just I've done the process that I was told to do.
And people can actually be incentivized to do nothing. Like that the least risky thing to do in some organizations is nothing. So if you take a risk and try to do something new and it's not perfect, or there's some problem that comes from that, or even a perceived problem that comes from that, not a real technical outage, but somebody waves a red flag and says, you didn't do this the right way according to our organization's definition of the right way, then that person can almost feel like they're in the middle of the Spanish Inquisition. And they're like, hey, like, I'm just trying to do a good job here. I'm trying to make things better.
Many years ago, I worked for a government organization that was pathological like this. In the description in that blog post about pathological organizations, they'd say large amounts of fear and threat. Right. And people in this government organization I was a part of for a few years operated in that mode of fear. You don't want to fly. You want to stay under the radar. You don't want to come up on the radar, because you might get blamed for something. You might get pinned for something. Consultants were used heavily because they were someone that you could blame. So you had fear if you took your own responsibility. So the idea was, bring the consultant in. We just did what the consultant said. So now you've got a place to blame shift and take some of that threat away. And then the power struggles were enormous. So between different people who control different budgets, you know, budgets and where money comes from being a very big deal in government organizations, having that control over that money and how it was spent was a symbol of your power within the organization. And keeping control of power was a very big deal. You wanted to be the one in charge, because that made you important, and it made what you said at meetings to be very relevant, and people paid attention to you, and maybe people over in the State House would care about you, and you'd be relevant and your position assured going forward, as the whims of politics and people coming and going due to elections changing things over the course of years. Pathological, you bet. It was a tough place to take risks and get anything done, because there was no reward for it, only risk.
Exactly. Yep. And that's in my mind, that's really a leadership problem. The people can help steer an organization one way or another. But if your leadership, it builds a incentive program that places blame and doesn't reward an entire group for successes, they or, you know, maybe withhold those rewards when you're not successful as a group, as a large part of an organization that must work together. If they do that in very granular ways, people are going to fight. Like if your bonus is on the line, they're going to care more about that than they're going to care about anything. So
it's the bonus question is interesting. I just want to diverge a little bit. Isn't it funny how hard people work for a bonus and yet it might add up to 2 or 3% of your overall salary package, or maybe 5% or even 10%. Any rational decision-making around a bonus should be to say it's not worth the effort, because usually people put in enormous hours or extra commitment or go above and beyond to try and earn the bonus. And really, you know, a couple of $1,000 is nice, but how much work did you have to put in to get it? You might as well have gone and worked nights at McDonald's and you might have had much more fun.
Less stress.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like, you know.
A lot of bonuses that I've seen handed out. And in fact, I had an article this week where there's a major employer in the US who's basically saying, representing a large number of US companies, he's basically saying that there are no pay rises coming. So if you are a worker in the US, and if there are no pay rises coming in the next 10 years unless you develop new skills. So the goal of automation will be to replace workers who do repetitive, low-value work with automation. So we're seeing that already in networking with software-defined, pick whatever. And the bulk of all of that software-defined stuff is it's taking away all the dull, repetitive work like, you know, configuring VLANs, monitoring WAN links, checking IP routing tables, that sort of stuff. And his point was that unless you're upskilling, there will be no more pay rises. So you have to be doing something. So if you're going to work hard on the figuration that you're going to, you're being tempted or driven to a pay rise, or maybe you're working for a bonus, that's going to go away. All of that sort of incentive-based working is dead. There won't be a future for it.
I think some organizations are going to do that, but there are still lots of really, I'll say backward-thinking organizations out there that are still running IT shops like an assembly line, and they treat people that way. You know, here, crank out 5 extra more widgets, and you're going to get a treat. Mm. I don't think that's the best way to run an IT organization, but a lot of them run that way.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of the bureaucratic and the process organizations again. So, we should get back to that, Yvonne.
Yeah,
we did divert a little bit.
The
three types, we talked about the pathological organization, and then we've also got bureaucratic and generative. Can you take us through those?
Sure. So a bureaucratic organization is really rule-oriented. It focuses on process, and there is a way we do things that we're still not going to encourage outside thinking or novelty that can cause us some problems. But, you know, people are going to talk to one another a little bit more. Folks are going to have narrow, defined responsibilities. And these organizations, depending on your personality, it may be a place where you can find your niche and do some work, but not be pressured too hard. But at the end of the day, the organization is still more focused on their process than the objective.
So Vogons. I say that because I was watching the old BBC Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from 1981, which is very low budget, but in one of the episodes, the Vogons are described as extremely bureaucratic and process oriented and so on. And there's a scene where one of the guards is being challenged by one of his prisoners to think outside the box and do something else. And no, he didn't. He just really liked his little niche and what it was that he was doing.
And I mean, if you're familiar with personality types and, you know, Myers-Briggs and you know the percentages, a lot of people are going to find a bureaucratic organization comforting. Like, I know the rules. I know what my job is. I know where I'm supposed to fit and what I'm supposed to do. And I can settle in and put the cruise control on, you know, set it And I know kind of every day what my life is going to be like and what work's going to be like. Now, those organizations aren't going to rock the world. But I think for some folks, it's tolerable.
Yeah. So much of that when I worked for a financial services group that was bought out by a big bank, and we ended up having to move our change control process over to what the big bank told us to do. And it went from we could make intelligent decisions about our change control and make updates to the network infrastructure or an application that would meet a specific customer's need. Guys, we got to move on this because big customer X has asked us to make this change to make their world better. So let's rush this through and get it done. That was the agility and capability that we had before the bank took us over. After the bank took us over, we had people that weren't familiar with our particular business reviewing our changes. And because the process said, if this group is trying to do a change and this other group is trying to do a change and this other group is trying to do a change all at the same time, well, you can't have that. That's too risky. You got to pick one and do it, even if the two or three changes happening simultaneously had nothing to do with each other. We would have to reschedule, put changes off, upset the customer as a result. Sorry, guys, we couldn't get an approval to make this change that you requested from us. But that's just where people were, as you described it, Yvonne, comfortable. They knew what their job was, and their job was, in this circumstance, say no to the change.
I have discovered that there are many, many, many people who really believe that their mission in life is to say no. And that's sad, but I think for those of us who want to impact change in our organizations and who want to move things forward, that's just a reality that we have to learn to cope with. If you've got more than five people together, right? I mean, one of them is going to be, challenging. So I don't know. It's part of people, unfortunately.
Yeah, I do think it comes back to, I just published a YouTube video recently. It's the end of May. It'll come out early June. About the fact that in technology, we don't ever actually have good technology. I think one of the mistakes we make in technology, and I'm going to leave out other parts of the organization because my experience of outward-facing business units is a little bit distressed, is that your information technology that we build is never actually good or excellent. The reality is that it either works or it doesn't. Have you ever watched a SpaceX launch? Like, Ethan?
They're inspiring.
Yeah, I know. Like, I can't help myself. I just want to watch all of them. But when the rocket's standing up, just before launch, they go through and say, like, engines are nominal, fuel tanks are nominal, onboard computer nominal, launch is a go. They didn't say the rocket is good or it's in excellent shape. They just say, it's nominal. And as the rocket goes through max Q, they go, yep, rocket's gone through max Q, everything is nominal. And that is exactly how our IT infrastructure works. Now, if you're a human who's been brought up through an education system that says, good job, nice work, strive hard and you'll get a reward, you don't want to walk around going, network works and nothing else, right? It worked as designed. Nominal. It's
that's
nominal,
boring.
Right? You can't go around and congratulate. In reality, IT infrastructure people need to be able to accept the fact that works as designed is an amazing thing. And of course, the executives that are in charge of the business are so used to doing subjective qualitative assessments on, this person's doing a great job. Well, what makes it great? Well, I don't know. I just judge them to be great. Therefore, it's great. Sort of very Trumpian, if you like,
I think so. One of the things that I always that fires my jets is when I'm working in an organization, either a day job or a volunteer organization, where I really feel like I'm part of the overall mission. Like, we as a group are accomplishing a thing. And when you think about what the network is, the network enables all this massive social change that we've seen. We've seen political uprisings start because folks were connected in ways that they hadn't been before. And without a network, that wouldn't happen. And we don't, in our organizations, we don't tie those pieces of the work to the overall mission of the organization. And I think for a lot of people, that's something that helps, is if you've got a leadership that says, okay, here's where you guys fit. Like, if you don't do your job, nothing works. And those things can be powerful motivators if people will use them. But instead, they just, they don't.
So we've got pathological organizations, bureaucratic organizations, and then we've got the third type here, generative organizations, Yvonne.
Yep, yep. And these are the movers and the shakers, right? These are the places where if in a pathological organization, the messenger is shot, and if in the bureaucratic organization, the messenger is neglected, in a generative organization, the messenger is trained. If somebody comes in and says, hey, I see this problem, or I see this new thing, they're like, oh, go figure that out. And people talk to one another well across groups. Risks are shared. In other words, if we do this thing, we're all going to do it together. And if there is a failure, we're not going to blame, you know, the person who stirred the tanks. You know, there's that great scene in Apollo 13 where the astronaut hits the button and stirs the tanks and blows, you know, part of the rocket up. And he says, I was sitting in the chair when they said start the tanks, so I started the tanks, right? Like, sometimes the person who hit the button is not their fault, but so often they end up taking the blame. And in generative organizations, that doesn't happen. I think where it talks about bridging, that's one thing I want to camp out here a little bit, because this is something I've always naturally done. Like in an organization, like I get to know the security people, especially the security people, because security network is so tightly coupled, and I've ridden the line between networking and security for a long time. But to go to other folks and say, what are you doing? What do you need from me? What can I do to help you do your job better? What are the problems that you're experiencing? What are the things that we could do to make your life better? And hopefully they'll reciprocate those questions. And if you're in an organization that will allow you to do that, you can have exponential results and move so much faster without failures just by communicating with people. And typically, that's not something you need permission to do. And frankly, I would say if you're in an organization that explicitly requests that you not do that, then you need to find somewhere else to be. That to me, that is a big red flag. If you can't talk to other people at your level across the organization and try and solve problems.
So this talking to other people thing, like using words?
Or I am, or, you know, Slack, or, you know, whatever.
There's a lot of things there, right? So I'm just being goofy. I've actually done the bridging thing myself, Yvonne, with similar success. And I had a boss who was phenomenal at it. He was the bridge between the business side and the IT side, was very, very good at explaining to the business side what IT's needs were, and then on the other side, understanding what the business needs were and then communicating that to IT. He was great at that and really changed the culture of the whole IT group, which before he'd come along, there was this adversarial relationship, and he managed to change all that through bridging. And then personally, as a technologist, I'd go and talk to other people who were not networking folks, but were security, the security people. Well, I lived kind of in both of those worlds anyway, but then the virtualization folks and even developers would talk to them and find out what they needed. And through the course of those conversations, it became much more clear what the challenges were and how technology could be brought to bear to solve the real problems rather than just flinging tickets at one another in kind of a contextless way. I need this done. Why do you need that done? And when you begin asking why this needs to be done and having a good, not confrontational, but cooperative sort of conversation, you can get to a better place in the end.
And I was going to say, you have to ask that why in the context of a relationship. Because if you don't, the perception is that your why is saying, well, I just don't want to do this. I'm going to make you justify it. And so there's a lot of relational stuff that has to go on to make all that work. And I think most of us who do technology for a living, we do it because we're more comfortable with screens than we are with people. And that has been revelatory to me to learn and observe how so much of my success has not been because of all the things that I know. It's because I've been able to build relationships and understand problems and maybe communicate those to the people who do know but don't understand the problem or have the relationship. I mean, you can solve a problem all day, but if you're solving the wrong one, it doesn't help anybody.
Hey, Greg, any luck with bridge building? I'm just curious how your experience has been.
I had a lot of success in a sense, for some arbitrary definition of success, with taking unusual approaches. Like, I was not normally a full-time employee, so I wasn't cursed with the burdens of full-time employees being worried about ongoing employment or staying around to get holidays or bonuses or any of that sort of stuff. I would come in for short periods. I don't really have much to say about the day-to-day sides of those sorts of work. But what I would do to make myself valuable to the organization is to be unusual, to be smarter. Because I was working at so many different companies over the years, I had a unique perspective on infrastructure. I understood how infrastructure was of value to the business. So I could sit in meetings and say, are we sure that this is what the business wants? Knowing with a fairly high degree of certainty that people in the room had no idea what the business even did. You know, most of them wouldn't even know that the purpose of the company was to make widgets, because they'd be arguing over which CPU they should buy, as if anybody cared. And that sort of stuff put me into a place where I was often a trusted confidant for executives. And so I'm not sure I have a whole lot to say about that. I generally just let organizations be organizations. They were bigger than I couldn't change them, and they weren't sure as heck weren't going to change for me. So I was sort of took a very stoic philosophical approach to it, which is can't do anything about it, can't change it, therefore I can't let myself care about it. I'll change the things that I can, and that's the way I generally work.
Well, maybe the next question, Yvonne, is to consider how you know what sort of an organization you're a part of. So a minute ago, you made the point, if you're in an organization that doesn't allow you to go talk to your peers that maybe work in a different silo, maybe you're in the wrong organization. Well, how do you know what sort of an organization that you're in? I know the blog post that we're referring to here about the Western typology has a whole bunch of questions that we can walk through.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite parts of this blog post, and like I said, it references peer-reviewed research that was done by Nicole Forsgren, and there's some great content out there all about these questions. But basically, they have six questions. They ask you to rate it from 1 to 7, whether you strongly disagree or strongly agree. And these are, I believe, these questions maybe came out of the organization Puppet. And they use these quarterly to evaluate their team culture. But I'm going to read them for the people listening. You can go check out the blog post too. But the first one is, on my team, information is actively sought. On my team, failures are learning opportunities and messengers of them are not published or are not punished. On my team, responsibilities are shared. On my team, cross-functional collaboration is encouraged and rewarded. On my team, failure causes inquiry, as opposed to, you know, beatings or punishment. On my team, new ideas are welcomed. And I think if you look at those questions, and if you can answer most of them, like 3 better, I'd say you're probably in an organization that is relatively healthy, if healthier than most. I'll say it that way. if we're talking about enterprise IT. If you read through all those questions and you're like, yep, one, yep, nope, nobody shares responsibilities. People don't seek information. People don't welcome new ideas. Anytime anybody fails, they're brought before an executive firing squad.
Look, a sacrifice has been brought to you to pay and atone for the failure.
That's right.
I want to know who did this so that we can, and I love it when the executives say, I want to know who did this so we can make sure that it doesn't happen again. And you go like, you want to fire them.
Well, but sometimes our failures are system failures. And I have actually seen circumstances in where changes sit in the change request system for so long, waiting for review, that by the time they get approved, that actually that change is no longer valid and causes problems when implemented. So when it was submitted, it was accurate. When it was peer-reviewed, it was correct. But by the time it makes it through the review process, now all of a sudden something else has changed, which makes that moot. And so we're actually getting in our own way, right? So whose fault was that? Well, that was the fault of the system. Not an individual. And I think so often we we don't look at it that way.
It's as I was looking through those questions, Yvonne, that you read through, they all of these just sparked something in my mind. Information actively sought. Yeah, I've been in places where it's like people would say to me, I don't actually want to know what you're trying to tell me. I have my own thing and this is what I do. And they just, they don't want to know. Failures as learning opportunities. I just wrote for a human infrastructure magazine about the value of postmortems and what you're supposed to get out of them. And learning opportunities is a key thing. Messengers not punished. That's a rough one. And it often comes down to managers.
What's interesting about those six questions is I've just been writing an ebook on career advice. And I've been looking at what sort of questions you should be asking in an interview. And there's six perfect questions right there. You know, you could say to the person that's interviewing you, you could say, if I was to work for your organization, like one of the things about the interview process is that people love it when you ask questions about them, partly because you're asking questions gives them insight into the things that interest you, and also because it stops them from driving the conversation. There's a tactical power play where people who are running the interview are often not very good at driving meetings or whatever. And so if you can take control of the meeting by asking questions, but those six points there are actually very good ways to frame questions around. So you want to know if the organization is actively going to support you. You know, if you need information, does it go out and fight it and support it? Are failures learning opportunities, or are you going to be shot? You know, so you could actually turn those into straight up interview questions, much less to get a sense of what this organization is that you're about to commit your personal life to.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point there.
I'm going to take that and put it straight into the ebook.
I like the responsibilities are shared point, because it doesn't say successes are shared. It says responsibilities are shared. And that's for better or for worse. There's not any one person that's typically in an IT. It's very rare that it's any one person that's responsible for a success or a failure. It's usually a number of people and or organizational decisions that bring about a certain circumstance. And so that's just a reflection of reality if you have a viewpoint that responsibilities are shared.
Well, and I read a book recently, and the source is unlikely, but I really believe that this book is probably the best guide for leaders who really want to digitally transform their organizations, to use the buzzword that's out there right now. And it's Team of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal. And what he is talking about is the transformation that the United States Armed Services had to go through in the mid-2000s to respond to Al-Qaeda, because they had this really hierarchical organization that was incredibly well-trained and incredibly skilled, but they could not respond to a threat because the organization they were working against was very nimble, was not hierarchical, And they were very, very nimble. They were able to move very quickly. And he walks through the changes that they had to make and the way they had to alter their thinking to change their organization to be much less top-down, to encourage people to take reasonable action without orders, right? Like you see something going on and you know that it's a problem, then you know what you need to do. You don't need to, you know... General McChrystal at one point said he got to the point where people would wake him up in the middle of the night to ask him to do something. And he realized he almost always told them yes, because they had more information than he had. And he realized that they don't need to wake me up. Like, I need to empower them to make the right decision. And so much of that book, I feel like, relates directly to the place that we find ourselves now in enterprise IT and how to think about our organizations and encourage people to work together. It was fascinating. It was unexpected. Somebody recommended it. It was Nick Russo actually who recommended it to me. And everybody who's interested in working in a healthy organization that's able to adapt over time should read it. Really, really good stuff.
Mm. I generally have the sense that most of the organizations that I've ever worked with are basically all idiots. And my general, and I think it does come across quite a bit, that I've never really experienced too many places that I've ever worked at that I would recommend anybody else to work at, really. But, you know, it's possible, I guess.
I think people are so often the victim of their environment. I mean, I think there are only so many highly, highly intelligent people in the world, then there's the rest of us, right? And there are people who work more successfully, and there are organizations who've taken the same people, changed their culture, changed their view of the world, and Continental Airlines is a great example. You know, they went from being the most hated airline in the world and not turning a profit to, like, in a year's time with new leadership, turning a profit, being a place where people wanted to work. So it's not always that people are all just morons. We all have some level of, you know, moron in us from time to time, present company probably included. But at the same time,
you know, not that so I'm going to admit to.
Right. And that's fine. I don't expect a big mea culpa. Yeah. But but I think so much of it is how we think about what our work and how we try to work, whether we work together and leverage one another or whether we just insulate and say, I'm going to do this all myself and I'm not going to let anybody in. And this is my, you know, I'm going to take my ball and play with it and nobody else can have it.
Well, that I want to go back to that idea that you mentioned from Team of Teams about empowerment and the ability to, for someone to make decisions. So I think I tweeted about this a while ago. The most difficult decision or the most difficult aspect of being a manager for me was allowing people to just do their thing without me getting right in their face and watching very closely. And there was an old Dilbert comic strip, move the mouse to the left, a little more now, click, you know, that sort of, you know, illustrating micromanaging, which I could tend to be guilty of because I didn't trust the people that were working for me enough to necessarily do it, do whatever their task was in either to get it right or to do it in the way that I wanted to do it, wanted them to do it or both. And that was a failure on my part. And that was a lesson I'd learned over time is just, you got to just let people do their thing. Or as a manager, I couldn't actually do my job of managing because I was too busy trying to do everybody else's job for them. So I thought that was interesting that he, General McChrystal, made that point. He's got to enable people to make decisions and you know, and move ahead, and but still have some response. I'm going to assume here that he still would have responsibility for their actions if they messed up, but he was willing to take that risk.
Right. But he also makes the point. He uses the terms complicated versus complex. And he says, in a complicated world, you can still map out every path and know the right way. And you can have people at the top who are capable of understanding every decision and what to do. But that our world and technology, I believe, too, has crossed a threshold into the land of the complex. And there is no one person who can understand it all. It is physically impossible for any one person in our organizations to have all the knowledge of state that they need to make the right decision. And that's you, that's me, that's our leadership, that's everybody. And so the only way that we can function in that kind of a world is that we work together and we communicate with one another and we build these, you know, teams that are coupled in ways that they can communicate with one another, because I'm not going to understand all the intricacies of storage, you know, and I'm not going to understand all of the super secret things that the security team has going on, especially when it relates to clients and endpoints. But our worlds touch and we have to be able to work together, you know, when we have problems, because there's no way that one person at the top can make the right decision. They are physically incapable of it. And I think coming to it with that level of humility and saying, I'm not going to know all the answers, that's where it's got to start. And that's really, I think, the hardest part, because I think I know.
Yvonne, you put a series of questions together here, and I think this is a good opportunity to jump into one of them to discuss. How do you tell the difference between a toxic team and a manageably dysfunctional team? And I'm interpreting that to mean a team that's gotten a hope versus a team that you can actually get through the dysfunction.
Sure. I mean, there are teams where you're like, I just can't do this. Like, this place kills my soul. And if you feel that way, like, you need to do something different because life's too short. But if you have from time to time energizing conversations with your peers, you have moments when you're getting ready to embark on a new project and you sit down and you talk about it, and there's a free flow of ideas and folks are exchanging information and they're bringing parts together, and at least the little world that you're in, you experience that from time to time. That's a really good thing. And it's a thing to value. And to not be too quick to walk away from. So I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, your day-to-day experiences and your relationships with the people that you work with in your circle, as opposed to, you know, our big, huge organization is, you know, climbing the stock market like crazy. And we're doing all these things because, I mean, ultimately for those of us in the places where we sit in the organizations, as long as we're still, our paycheck still cashes, that doesn't mean as much to us at our level in the organization. So I think it's, do you like the people you work with? Do you feel like you can get things done?
I think there's also a point. I want to express some, I agree with everything you've said, Yvonne, and I want to express some caution here. Don't feel that you're responsible for fixing the organization. It's really important that even if you recognize that an organization is dysfunctional or, you know, following one of these pathologies that we've talked about here, and they're not necessarily good or valuable pathologies, the point of talking about this is so that you can realize them, that you have the self-awareness to create acceptance. So if your organization is pathologically dysfunctional, you know, as we talked about, just understand that and try and find ways for you to accept that and then make the most of the situation that you're in, because you, the sort of people who are listening to this, are engineers and technical experts. You're not a manager. You're not going to have responsibility for rebuilding the company culture. You can participate in the culture, but you can't fix it. And if you push at it, you're actually going to make yourself very unhappy, because you're never going to win, because you're not the person who's going to fix it.
Well, and I think one of the things that I realize, I think, you know, 20 years into my career that I didn't realize 3 years in, is how much leadership matters. And most of us, not that we don't matter, but there are things we can't change because we are not in a position of authority in our organization to change it. But one of the things you can do is you can look for those people that are more generative, that are trying to bridge across their organization, and you can latch on to them. One of the most successful times of my career was an organization in which we almost had a secret underground technical leadership team. There were six of us who, across all different subject matters in the IT organization, who knew one another, who shared with one another, and we would be like, "Hey, my manager came to me and said we were doing this. Are you hearing anything about that?" And they'd be like, "Yeah, they said blah 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 blah." And then we would like huddle, not secretly, but also not in any way that we were advertising, and solve problems so that when we went to our leadership, we were going with a unified message. And if you're in an organization that will allow you to do that, you can get things done sort of sometimes despite leadership. And so, you know, find those people who are like-minded, who will work with you. And you can make more progress than you think. But no, you can't change the culture of an entire organization. You can't do that.
So where's the line then between being able to muddle through manageably dysfunctional and then it's too toxic? Because there's got to be a place there where it's if you can't fix it and you're just not happy. And sure. Right, as you said, some of us as engineers, we're not going to be the people that make that change. We're not hierarchically in the position to do that. Where's the line where it's too toxic? What does that mean? And then right. Is the solution just to get out, find another job?
I think it starts with knowing what you want to get out of your career and what you hope to get out of the particular organization that you're in. Like, there are times when you're like, there are some skills I need to learn, or I need to be in this organization in this particular vertical for a certain period of time to help further my career. And it's worth tolerating whatever I'm tolerating to have this 3-year stint on my resume or whatever that is. But I mean, ultimately, if you're not sleeping at night, if you're sick, if you're, you know, if you got ulcers and you're going to the doctor, you know, all the time because the stress of your job is causing you real life issues, it's time to do something else. But, you know, a lot of those decisions are about, you know, am I willing to travel? What does that mean for my family? And so our lives aren't just our careers. And so you have to do some of that calculus, whether if you have small children at home, that may be a very different answer than if your kids are grown and you have more freedom and flexibility. Or, you know, it'll depend on the health of your, you know, if you've got aging parents, or if you, you know, there's all kinds of life circumstances that will inform this decision. But, you know, you need to think about yourself and where you want to get to, and does where I'm at now fit with that? And can I, and if you know that, it sometimes will make your environment more tolerable because you are working toward your own personal goal. And you can remind yourself on a really bad day, I'm doing this because I decided X, Y, and Z. And at some point when that calculus shifts, you do something different.
Oh, baby, managing expectations. That is so much of it. If you walk in thinking you're going to change the company and change the world, and by the time I'm done with this place, we're going to have it all whipped into shape, and then you run into process problems or toxicity in the way the teams operate, or just an organization that's not going to work with what it is you think you're trying to do. You end up with stress and disappointment and frustration and managers telling you to back off and calm down and so on. But if your expectation is, yeah, okay, so it's kind of not a great organization, bureaucratic and difficult to work with different people because of the way the structure is, and that's okay, because you know what? I've always wanted to work on, I don't know, an Arista network, and they're running an Arista backbone here, and that's a big deal to me, so I'm going to sit and I'm going to park and learn that and learn these three other things, and they have this one really cool app and a really interesting development team that I get to spend a little bit of time with. I'm going to get some things out of that, then when I've gotten what I can, I'll go. If you set your expectations that way, your mindset is that it becomes, I wouldn't say easy, but easier to survive in a difficult environment and then move on when the time comes, as you put it, Yvonne, when that the calculus changes.
Yep. And I think we make some assumptions about people that are just wrong. We assume that we and other people make decisions based on rational criteria. And I don't think that's true. and there's another book. I'm sort of a book reader, an audiobook fan, but The Undoing Project, which is about Kahneman and Tversky, who won a Nobel Prize for all things economic psychology. But what they studied was, do people make rational decisions about the economics of their lives? And what they realized was, no, they don't. And so much of the work of economists assumed that people made rational decisions. A perfect example is they would give people 5 seconds to answer the question. So they didn't have time to do the math. And they would ask them, what's 1 × 2 × 3 × 4 × 5 × 6 × 7 × 8? And they would, you know, come up with an answer. And then they would ask them the question in reverse. Okay. So, you know, separated by time. Okay. So what's 8 × 7 × 6? Well, if they started with the higher number, the vast majority of people, although we know the answer is the same, would guess a higher answer, right? So just the way that you frame the question changed the way that people answered it. And I think we believe that people are rational, and they're just not. You know, we don't always make decisions based on facts. And I think accepting that fact has made me much more like okay with the way the world is, because they're just not being rational.
I think that's important to understand, is that many companies, especially when you get through the door of a new job, you come in with high hopes, and emotionally you've been through a very difficult process of the interview, and you've just made a big decision maybe to resign where you are, or you've been booted out of your previous employer because they went broke. I mean, again, as part of this research for the career book, it's now your average company on the Fortune 500 will now only last 15 years. Before it's bought, acquired, or dismembered, right? And so you will not have a career with one company for your entire life. You can expect to change jobs at least every 5 to 10 years. And as automation comes through, that process is going to accelerate. You're going to have, well, I call it extreme ownership of your career. You're going to need to be very consciously thinking about where you are and where you're going. And if you're not training yourself for this emotional process of getting a job and getting a new job and changing jobs, you're going to have a problem. But when you get through the door and you put your bum on that seat and you start working, you're emotionally, you're ready to work hard, you've got so much to learn, you're looking at all the people around you, you've got to get used to them. Having this framework in which to think about things gives you a way to mitigate the stress of that emotional adaptation, so that you can look around and you can say, well, that person's the, you know, that's the manager, but obviously he obviously delegates heavily to this person over here who seems to be a key person. So if I want to impress said manager, maybe I need to impress that key influencer over there. Or, you know, this organization is process oriented. Therefore, I need to take the dial on my personal process orientation and make sure I do my timesheets every Friday because that'll get me in the good books. You know, you need to understand or have this awareness of what's going on around you. You can't just come in through the door and pull on the technology lever and say, I'm the greatest technologist ever. That's all that matters. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And one of the things that sort of troubled me is I have, and I talk to lots of especially network engineers and I, you know, I read fairly broadly, not just inside of the networking sphere. And I'll recommend a book like the two that I've talked about. They're like, well, I've got all kinds of technical stuff I'm reading. And when I get through that, well, maybe I'll read it. And my response, or I usually don't say it, but what I think in my mind is, that's not all there is. Like, that's not all you need to know to be successful. And we need to branch out a little more, I think.
Yeah, the irony of technical books being, they tend to be so detailed. It's very difficult to walk away with all of that detail in your head. So I found it's good to survey a technical book, but you really need to read other things too, and not just have your head in the protocols and header bits that you're not going to remember 5 minutes after you put the book down, unless you happen to need that information the next day or something. Other books are helpful too.
Yep. Or conversations. Like, books are great because they don't get in your face and they don't stress you. But I think there's another way to build out your emotional intelligence, which is effectively what a part of what we're talking about here, a big part about, is building up this awareness of what's going on around you, this emotional intelligence, to be sensitive to the organization, to be sensitive to the people that are in it. And a way to do that is to go and get involved in local user groups or get to conferences and meet with people, or even to you know, get out from under the invisible envelope of I work inside a company, never let people, you know, get onto social media and participate and learn and think, you know, participate in those things and start thinking about what other people want. Be sensitive to what other people are doing and you'll be a better employee.
Absolutely. Yep.
It's the best thing social media ever did for me was teach me how to think about people as, well, people.
Well, and I think for me too, my very first Cisco Live, and I've said this in other forums, you know, changed my career, because I realized, first of all, that there was so much more out there to know, because many of us get inside of our organizations and we're kind of the top, right? We're the one that people go to and we don't have anybody else to lean on. And then you show up at a place like that where you've got all these people from all these different verticals, or they work in a service provider, or they work in a different kind of enterprise. And you realize there's so much to know, and that can be overwhelming, but it can also be encouraging, inspiring to see people who are doing different stuff and expand your horizons a little bit. So, yep.
I once interviewed a guy who'd spent 5 years running a Cisco ASA IPsec VPN. And at the end of that 5 years, he was unemployable because he didn't know routing or switching or whatever. He was, you know, knew his ASA VPNs pretty well. Not awesome, but he knew the particular deployment that he'd set up once 6 years ago. But I couldn't hire him because that was all he did.
Yeah. And I've heard people say, you know, a lot of people have 10 years of 1 year experience at a company. So, I mean, ultimately they've got, you know, 1 year of experience. They've done that 10 times. don't be that person, right?
Yeah, that's really tough too, because sometimes 10 years in a big company could mean 10 different roles, or it could mean 10 years of the same experience, 10, you know, 1 year's experience 10 times over. You've got to dig a little harder.
Well, guys, I think we've done the topic to death pretty well today. Yvonne, I wanted to go through your book recommendations just one more time, so people have those in your head in their head. You mentioned Team of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal, and then you mentioned another book, and there was yet another one I don't think came up yet on our list.
Yeah, so I mentioned Team of Teams, talked about that a lot. The Undoing Project, which is about Kahneman and Tversky and their work in economic psychology. And I know that doesn't sound exciting, but it's thrilling. It's a great book. The other one is called Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And I know a very large VAR for which this is a required reading for other people. And if you kind of want a picture of what a healthy team looks like, questions like, is conflict within a team a good thing? And the answer to that question is actually yes. You know, but what other characteristics does a team need to function well? It's a great book. I read it in one sitting on an airplane. Super helpful. So The Undoing Project, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and Team of Teams by Jennifer McChrystal. So that's my list.
And Yvonne, we know you're very social. How can people follow you, read your stuff, et cetera?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, and you can find me on Twitter at Sharp Network. I do blog at esharp.net, and you can find me all the time at the Network Collective, which is a community that I'm building with Jordan and Russ White to try and, you know, educate folks who want to do networking. So,
yes, and you guys are on YouTube and so on. Yes, okay. Yep. And so the links to all of that, if you want to follow Yvonne, Yvonne's recommended reading on these topics, all of that will be in the show notes, which you can find at packetpushers.net. Or if you look in your podcatcher, we've got the show notes reflected there as well. So you should be able to scroll and find the links and click right through on your phone or whatever your podcast listening device is. And that does bring us to the end of the Packet Pushers weekly show for today. Now in its ninth year, which startling, but yeah, now it's 90 years.
Can I plug my own book?
Oh, yeah.
I'm writing this ebook. It'll be available through Packet Pushers. It'll actually be available through our own membership system. And if you become a member, you'll be able to access it. It encompasses some of the ideas of what Yvonne was here, but some of what I've talked about here today is encapsulated in that book. And I've been writing it for just over 6 months now. So hopefully it's got some useful information. It's very focused on what we do. It's about being an infrastructure person and the sorts of ideas that you should have as an infrastructure in terms of planning your career and living your career and what the future of your career and trying to sort of peer forward into this and that principle of extreme ownership of your career. Don't rely on a company to do it for you.
And that's a perfect point that underscores that Packet Pushers is a network of podcasts, blogs, newsletters, community discussions, and videos helping you with professional career development, so much more than just the podcast. And if you're getting value out of the things that we're sharing with you, the things you're reading, the things you're hearing at Packet Pushers, please tell your friends. If you only listen to the podcast again, you are missing out. If you'd like to talk to us, tweet at Packet Pushers, follow us on LinkedIn, and then rate us on Apple Podcasts. That would be a big win for us. Apple Podcasts is still the way that people discover more podcasts to listen to. And if you rate us highly, we get show up in the rankings and more people are likely to discover us. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.